From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1964 in East London. English sociologist Ruth Glass coined the term gentrification to describe a specific phenomenon she was noticing there. Middle-class pioneers were migrating into older working-class districts, purchasing and renovating run-down buildings, and eventually displacing long-time poorer residents. The term stuck. By the 1970s, social scientists in the United States were using that term, gentrification, to describe similar trends in American cities. But whatever you want to call it, gentrification has been happening for much longer than the term has been around. Gentrifiers in the United States have been predominantly white, though not always, and sometimes we hear the term gentrification used purely in pejorative terms. But how can it be a good development? Well, here's where we give credit to our colleagues at Open Mic Rochester. Journalist Tiana Magnon wrote a wide-ranging piece on gentrification in Rochester and explored how it's not only about income or new residents, it's about what happens when new residents displace not only people, but old traditions, culture, and values as well. This hour, we follow Open Mic's lead and expand on that discussion on gentrification. My guests include the editor-in-chief of Open Mic Rochester, Tiana Magnon. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is George Moses, executive director of Northeast Area Development in Rochester and Group 14621. George, welcome to the program.
I was glad to be here.
And on the line with us is Bob Boyd. He's the former executive director of the South Wedge Planning Committee. Bob, welcome to the program to you as well.
Thank you.
All right, Tiana, I'm going to start with you. Just how this got on the radar screen and what convinced you to kind of dive into the subject of gentrification?
Oh, yeah. Just working at a black magazine, we hear it all the time, gentrification. And I recently moved into the Market View Heights neighborhood. And, you know, I've been kind of following it in the Beechwood neighborhood and the 19th Ward and that kind of thing. So as soon as I had a little bit of time, I decided this is something I wanted to explore. So I took that time last week, did a bunch of interviews, and I didn't know anything about it before. So it was really my chance to learn as well.
Okay. And when you would hear about that term gentrification in your work for Open Mic, usually what was the context you were hearing it in?
Oh, for the most part, it's usually used negatively. It's, you know, people coming in, like you said, normally white people coming in and displacing poor black people. And then really you think of it as, you know, the suburbs coming into the city and just changing the city to be like the suburbs. And for me, you know, just as a journalist, it was about, you know, there's more to this. So I did a bunch of interviews with people from Rachel Barnhart to George Moses to try and get a wide spectrum of, you know, ideas and that kind of thing to fully understand it.
And by the way, Rachel Barnhart, not because she's running for mayor necessarily,
but
because she is someone who moved into
She lives in Beechwood.
Moved into Beechwood. Mm-hmm. And you wanted to get her thoughts. You talked to George. We're going to talk to George in a moment. You talked to Ann Howard from RIT.
Yep.
It was this really interesting and, to me, thoughtful, wide-ranging piece on gentrification. I cannot recommend it highly enough. You should
Thank
be reading
you.
Open Mic Rock anyway. It's openmicrock.com if you want to check it out there. George, for you, what is the, when you hear the term gentrification, what is the short definition you have in your mind of what it is?
Whenever I hear the term, the first thing I do is pause and I ask folks and clarify, tell me what you actually mean, because language is important. For the most part, it's a change. And so where I always try to engage folks at is, okay, well, are we going to let change just occur? Are we going to manage it? Are we going to be a part of this change? And in really understanding, because as you actually articulated very well, the history of the gentry and what gentrification is, understand what it is and not necessarily say, well, I'm not going to let it happen, not realizing what you're actually saying. Because I would ask some folks, because then you're using also a term called mixed income communities, and I would ask them, so do you mean I can't stay here either? Because I stay on Parcells Avenue and I have a two-income family. And some people would actually say, well, are you a gentrifier? And I think what an important piece of Tiana's article, she talked about the culture and the character and not trying to come in as I am the superhero. We were having a great conversation beforehand. I'm coming in to save these folks because obviously they have no culture or character. I'm going to come and bring it.
Well, I think this is where it's important to kind of point out there's George is so right. I mean, we hear gentrification in so many different contexts, usually negative, but I'm sure we'll get calls and people want to express, well, does that mean I can't move to a neighborhood like this? Or, you know, and we'll talk about that. But sometimes people, George, sometimes people have really good intentions. They may move in, as you said, usually white people, and they'll see, you know, a dilapidated building or a house that needs some repair, and they'll think, well, I'm here to help save this. I'm here to help spruce things up. And it's maybe a noble intention in their heart, but what could the impact be?
Well, I'm going to say hi to Bob Boyd, because Bob and I were actually colleagues and working in another neighborhood organization. But one of the things you're going to hear is, you would normally see before and after pictures. People are familiar. Here's what it looked like before, and here's what it looked like after. And one of the things that Tian and I really got and discussed is the before, the mm-hmm. before. What happened that it got to this? There is a story that will help you understand this. So helping folks actually understand that something happened. You hear terms of benign neglect, where sometimes there's disinvestment by government that caused this. So you want to really discuss those things, for more importantly, so that you don't repeat a vicious cycle.
Okay. Bob, how do you define gentrification?
Well, I agree with George that this is, it's what the definition is. If we go back to, and I'll go back to facts, mainly because my current role is I'm the faculty at School of Business in SUNY Geneseo. So I've been looking at facts around this gentrification a little bit. And when we've seen gentrification happen, I think it's important to see that it is because of population growth, more so than people wanting to move into an area. And in New York City, what you had was Manhattan is so full and people keep coming in and coming in. And as a result, they keep moving over to Brooklyn, up to Queens, and totally changing the neighborhood. And I think in Rochester, we don't have the growth. So I think we got to make sure what we're talking about, are we talking about people who want to come back into the city because they appreciate city living, that they really grew up in this, they grew up in the city, moved to the suburbs, now they're getting older, and they want to move back in. So I think that's I think that's an important thing to look at. And also, when you look at a community, to have this, we use the model, George, if you remember, the three-legged school.
That's right.
Stool, that we need a community that's engaged. We need businesses that can provide for services, and we need good quality housing. And everybody thinks the South Wedge, and one of the things I think we did fairly successful there is we are economically diverse. We're not, when you look at some of the numbers, George, I think if you look at some of yours, the Wedge is actually poorer. But what we have is we have a third of the people make less than $25,000, and we have a third making over $50,000. So in the Wedge, what's happened is we've actually been able to maintain that mix of income. And I think that's because when we look at the quality of the housing, we have some very small units that as much as you can try to, you can't take a house that's 800 square feet or 1,000 and make it 2,000. It just doesn't work. So I think we've been able to keep the mix, and I think that's what's been reflected in the article, is we have the mix. And we also have the mix between those that have high school degrees and those that have college degrees and above. We're almost a third of the people in the neighborhood have less than a high school or below, while 42% have over. So I think in the South Wedge, there's been a big focus of, you know, keeping that uniqueness. And we've found that people who have moved in because they want city living more than they want a change in neighborhood.
Right.
So that's just sort of my two cents. It's really about growth. And in City Rochester, we don't have growth. Monroe County, we don't have growth. So I think the impact may not be as bad as if we're looking at a traditional approach.
Yeah, and Tiana's piece had me thinking about not just, again, displacement, but culture, respecting traditions, respecting history, more than I think I've ever thought about when it comes to gentrification. And go ahead, Bob.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the biggest thing, in that if somebody comes into a neighborhood and they don't want to be part of the neighborhood, like they come in and they say, oh, I don't like this affordable housing tower. The people in the tower are I don't want to be with them. Well, they're part of our community. You know, if you have different agencies, we have ABVI Goodwill. And some people say, oh, we don't want all these social services things, you know. And I think that's where it leads to problems. I think, George, would you say the same thing?
Yeah, I would. And so one of the main things that we're really focusing on, and again, Tiana really made me go back to do my research on this, and I told her I appreciate her for this, and to really let residents know that you have agency in this. We are mm-hmm. absolutely folks who live in the neighborhoods. You are not helpless victims in this.
Right.
I'm going to give a few concrete examples.
Yeah, please.
As Bob talked about, there's social justice, but I also believe in economic justice. So you have to not just do the housing, but you got to do the economic infrastructure. So we have the Freedom Market, which we own. The neighborhood organization owns. Carl Kingsley, who was the former owner of it, he was very intent on keeping the culture. So he said, I didn't want to sell to someone who was not necessarily from this country. How about I want a neighborhood organization to get into this? We worked out a deal that was beneficial for him and beneficial for the neighborhood. Now we have the store in the neighborhood. The neighborhood owns it. And what we were able to do is to bring back the tradition, the positive tradition of the mom and pop stores.
Well, even better, it doesn't sell certain things either. So it's kind of a role model kind of store. When you have all of these other stores, you get liquor, you just litter everywhere. So
right, you're bringing back the culture that was there. That's what was so important. And another example on the economic structure, a lot of folks know Soccer Sam from Salvatore's, Sam Fantuzzo. Mm-hmm. He's another person because a lot of folks, as Bob said, actually grew up in the neighborhoods. When you start to talk to them, they were there. He has always had this thing about nostalgia, bringing back the good old days, the things that were great that we all grew up in. Because I know this neighborhood, and Tiana and I were talking. I know her street. That was Skateboard Hill when I was graduating from high school. But Soccer Sam wanted to reinvest back in the old neighborhood. So he knew the before. He knew what it could be because it was that. So he said, okay, we're going to invest and put it a Salvatore's, Speedy Slice, a concept that you could actually have folks have not just create jobs, but ownership back in the neighborhood. These are things that you got. We have agency, and these are things that the neighborhood organization is doing. These are things that we can do. So not just to say, oh, no, somebody's coming in to change it. I'm just going to be a victim. And it's, oh, no.
No.
You're here. You're alive. You have say. Get engaged in this and understand it.
Right. Now, make sure
and
that
when we did that a lot ahead, in the Southwest, we engaged people in the community. I can think of one instance when a certain hospital wanted to expand. You know, they wanted to do this, and this, and they're going to try to make us better. And as a community, we engaged the community and caused change. And I think that's it becomes important is, as George said, for neighbors to become involved in this process and take control over it. Because businesses who want to move in want to be successful. So when you look at that, you want to bring businesses in that everybody's going to be happy with, as the Freedom Market is.
Well, as we go throughout this discussion, listeners, if you've got questions or comments, I'd love to hear your thoughts on gentrification in Rochester. You know, how is it impacting your neighborhood? Is your neighborhood, wherever you live, is it sort of withstanding change in a good way, as George says? Because I'm seeing kind of this fork in the road that can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got people who want to maybe move to the city, maybe move back to the city, maybe people like me who did not grow up in the city of Rochester but would want to eventually live there. And I'm reading Tiana's piece and I'm thinking, at the very least, I'm going to learn the history, I'm going to respect my neighbors, I'm going to not try to push people out or change culture, but also try to kind of respect that and become more of a part of that. But I feel like there's this fork in the road. You can see maybe some growth in neighborhoods, but respectful growth that still respects mixed income, that still leaves room for people in different backgrounds. And then you can have gentrification in the way that the English sociologist Ruth Glass coined the term in the 1960s, where you see people actually pushed out. We have a community that already has one of the highest concentrations of poverty and extreme poverty, which means we've got neighborhoods where people largely don't have work and are feeling really, really stressed by poverty. We know that RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, is working on that. But if gentrification happens in really the negative way, I mean, George Moses, aren't we going to see even more of that, more concentration, if we allow gentrification to keep pushing people out of neighborhoods where they have lived in for many, many years?
Well, one of the things, and you can look in the RMAPI report, and I'm actually on one of the subcommittees, where the people have spoken, and I'm very clear. We want to stay. And matter of fact, we're not asking you to stay. We're staying. Here are the other things that we want to better our neighborhood. We don't, just because someone is coming in doesn't mean that we didn't want these same services. Mm-hmm. We want the same services too. But we want them now. Why do we have to wait until someone else comes in? We want these services now. Again, we have agency. And Tiana and I were joking, the term empower just really irritates me because it connotates that I have your power, and based on my benevolence, whether or not I'm going to give it back to you. People, they already have it. It's just a lot of, you got to educate people on some of the things that it's just there.
And how to use it.
And how to use it. Mm-hmm. And then once they start using it, it's funny, especially the older folks. It's so cute and it's funny when they use the power they already have because they know the neighborhood already. They have the historical advantage. They are the keepers of the culture. And when you watch it and say, okay, well, here, oh, I didn't know I could have done that. You let them be the change.
Listeners, it's 844-295-TALK to join the program. We'd love to hear from you. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or if you're calling from Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Tiana Magnon's piece sparked this discussion. You should check out openmicroc.com, and we'll make sure we link to the piece as well about gentrification. I want to ask, well, all of our guests, and Tiana, you can weigh in on this if you'd like. Did you find in your work that there is a particular place in this city where gentrification has happened more than others, or there is more of a concern where it's causing more stress for residents than others right now?
Ooh, I think you guys might have to talk about that.
I figured you might pivot to George and Bob.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in Market View Heights, so I see it firsthand, but I also want to recognize, you know, as a journalist, there is that kind of bias that I live in that neighborhood, so I do see it. But I also know, just from a little bit talking to George here, that Beechwood is seeing it a lot, and then just having those neighborhoods around Beechwood, we kind of got into a conversation on my Facebook page about how this works. You know, you have these huge homes on the other side of, you know, Hazelwood. We call it the Great Hazelwood Divide, where if you go on the other side of Culver, the homes are expansive, mm-hmm. and they have, you know, the Hummers in the driveway. And it's not about, you know, people coming from the suburbs into Beechwood. Another way it happens is they're trying to go onto that side of Culver, but maybe they're priced out. Maybe they can't move into that neighborhood for whatever reason, but they still have that same culture. And so they're going to move a little bit further into Beechwood, maybe, you know, a couple streets down from their ideal neighborhood, but that's still going to change the Beechwood area. So I would say, I mean, you can talk about that a little bit more probably than I can.
George?
And I'm really listening because, again, this is a learning experience. I never come to the table claiming that I know everything. I'm very interested in, because you live on High Street. Mm-hmm. You are now going to be not only the keeper and developer of that new culture. So I'm interested to see, that's my old neighborhood. And it's actually not Market View Heights. It's actually NEPCA. And I thought about that. Oh. But you don't have a neighborhood organization there right now.
That's why they were looking at me so weird. They're like, hi, are you sure? And then the other guy was like, right. No, it is in Market View Heights. She belongs here.
Right. So you find somewhere to belong is one of the big pieces. So I'm listening to it because I'm learning from this at the same time. And it's actually just bringing up more questions because, again, my message in this is the folks that are there, you're not victims in this, that understand how this change process works, really get it. So that there's a cycle, because Ann Howard said in your article, it's neither good or bad. It just is. Mm-hmm. Change, we will evolve.
But it can be bad.
I mean, if it's not managed,
if
you just sit on the sidelines and let people do stuff in your neighborhood, good luck on those results. Don't sit on the sidelines.
George wants people engaged.
Get engaged.
Change affects everybody. And when I think, if you think about this, just humor me because I'm old. Is we have Monroe County, which is population has been flat and will be flat for the next 5 years. So if people are moving into the city, they're moving out of suburban areas. Mm-hmm. So will that cause a reverse gentrification, that those that may be of lower income may be moving to the suburbs because it's cheaper?
That's a great question. So if folks from the city move to the suburbs, are they gentrifiers? Or is it just the income?
What is it doing? I just know South Wedge numbers. Our median income is $48,000, and in Monroe County it's $78,000. So if we have more of these people making all this money coming in, they're moving from somewhere. Or am I thinking of something wrong?
No, we have to. For me, I'm so glad that you actually brought that point up, because we have to ask other questions, because we see a lot of deconcentration mythologies. And most of it's just moving people around. Because when you say you move the people out of the neighborhood, they don't actually die. Where do they go?
Right.
they go somewhere. So wouldn't it make sense to say, okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about it. It's not just say, well, we kicked them out. Where did they go, and where are they going to go, and what opinions will they have, or perspectives will they have once they get there? So one of the things we're asking for is just have a much deeper discussion on this, not just have the surface conversation.
We're not seeing any growth. If we were growing as a city or community by 5-10% like New York is, we'd have gentrification, simply because there's more people and not enough housing, and we have an excess of housing.
But Bob, you're talking about gentrification for two separate reasons. One, a natural sort of bulge in the population where people have to go somewhere, versus people making choices to go inhabit neighborhoods where they have not lived in before because it's either cool or there is something attractive about it or there are opportunities because prices are low and they want to get a piece of property that's maybe a lower price and then they can renovate and rehab and all those things that, you know, again, is not necessarily a negative thing but has consequences for people living there. And so when you say that we don't have gentrification, we don't have population gentrification, but we still have choice gentrification, don't we?
Yeah, I think to some degree, yes. But I think people, there's still got to be, if I'm going to make an investment in a community by buying a home, I might see it as a being a good deal and I can make money, but I still have to deal with the market price for rents.
Yeah, so I can actually talk to that a little bit. I asked Ann Howard about that. We were talking about, you know, what creates gentrification. And she said the same thing. You know, in Boston, New York City, you have this market that people want to purchase into. Right now in Rochester, our market isn't the most attractive, but we have affordability. So, right now, we are in the process of, you know, if we continue to develop parts of Rochester, we continue to make it a very attractive city, and we already have very affordable homes, well, now we are just one step away from making, you know, the city as attractive as it needs to be for people to feel like, you know, this investment, instead of it being a $20,000 house or a $30,000 house, it's a $30,000 house that comes with a booming center city, a great stadium down the street or something like that. So I think you're right in terms of, you know, we're not at that point yet, but I think it's even better to have these conversations before we get to the point where we are an attractive market and now we have to deal with the fact that, you know, people are coming in not only because our homes are affordable, but because they want to be, you know, taking advantage of everything.
I think that's mm-hmm. well said. Let me grab our first phone call. John in Rochester wants to jump in. Go ahead, John.
Hoping to put some flesh and bones on the conversation and
sure.
also bring up some public policy interventions. So I moved into, me and my wife and another couple bought a duplex near Village Gate in 1992. There was no neighborhood of the arts at that time. It was a neighborhood that was not a neighborhood that everyone was dying to move into. We picked up a duplex for $89,000. We picked it up. We moved in and split the house with another couple because it was close to, it was within walking distance to where I worked and the other couple as well. So that was in 92. Within 8 years, this neighborhood had become neighborhood of the arts. So we got millions of dollars invested pouring into our neighborhood to kind of shine it up a little bit. We were the first, you know, we didn't know what we were doing, but when we moved in, we were the first white bohemian wave of people into this neighborhood. It was convenient. And it was affordable. But, you know, 25 years later, what's gone on? My housing value has increased 50%. So it's now assessed at $135,000. Now people say that's great. I say my family is out thousands and thousands of dollars that we paid in taxes above and beyond what we thought we would be paying when we moved into a neighborhood mm-hmm. that was not so desirable. We've been able to absorb that because as we've gone into our 40s and 50s, our earning potential has gone up. But if we were senior citizens on fixed incomes, we would have been pushed out of the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, we were the white professionals with master's degrees that moved in on the street, and it was like, hi, other white professionals down the street. But we were the minority. Now we're the majority. So our street is no longer heterogeneous. It's homogeneously, you know, now we're not the exceptions. We're the rule on our street. So up and down the street, Caucasian Americans with master's degrees up and down the street. Things have changed. People, their rent went up, they moved out. I hate to say it, but we pushed people out of the neighborhood. So this is reality. We now see this going on in Plymouth Exchange as the University of Rochester crosses the river, and there is speculation going on. People are coming in. People in the neighborhood, there's about there's several dozen seniors who are owner-occupants in Plymouth Exchange neighborhood. They get letters every week asking them to sell out to people all over the United States and apparently even the world. So these are people coming in. They read a course. They learned how to flip a house. So they're looking to make money because there's something indicates that Plymouth Exchange is a neighborhood that's quote unquote up and coming, right? So they're going to jump in and feed off of that carcass, and that's going to change the name. That's going to change the feel of a traditionally African American community, and this is a lot of pressure there to push those families and those senior citizens on fixed incomes out of the neighborhood. It's not, you could, you know, is it a nefarious plot? I don't know, but it's real. It's happening. And the fact of the matter is that City Hall has absolutely no plans in place to address that. So, you know, George and I have talked about, land trust. Look at the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston. That would, there are ways to preserve affordability without, in terms of development corporations. But also there's things that City Hall could do. So, for instance, City Hall could create a tax assessment freeze like they did in Atlanta for seniors on a fixed income if the neighborhood starts to heat up. And that would be an actual public policy that City Hall could do. It's what they call displacement mitigation, right? So to try to hold harmless people in the neighborhood when its neighborhood starts to experience some of those development pressures. So I just wanted to put that out there.
And I want to comment,
real.
John,
people
I appreciate
really
you.
People get hurt, and there's stuff we can do about it.
John, can you stay on the line for 1 second? Because I'd love to follow up, and I know George does as well.
Yes.
I just want to say, I really admire sort of the ownership John's taking and looking at saying, maybe it wasn't our intention, but we were part of the leading edge of what became gentrification in a neighborhood. George, you want to start?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I would ask some questions. When you talk about displacement mitigation, because there's a campaign that we actually launched, and it's actually John and I actually worked on, where a lot of the seniors were saying, what do you need for you to stay in your neighborhood? And what did they say, John? They said, we need to have some work done in our houses. We need roofs. And we were very successful at that program. But that was something that was pushed from the neighborhood. Because I tend not to want to always wait for City Hall to do everything. I believe that we have agency in this. And that was actually a very successful campaign. So there are things that people need who want to stay in there. And the seniors spoke very clearly. Tons of them turned out at City Hall and said, we need help on our homes. We don't have the resources to fix our homes up. We need help. And City Hall responded. Because there are a lot of folks, and I hear it even more across the neighbors, where folks are saying, help us stay in our homes because we don't have the money. I would agree on there is a role that you have to make sure that government does not disinvest in neighborhoods. Again, we go back to the old New Jersey incident with benign neglect, where government is actually complicit and actually disinvest in a neighborhood so that developers can come in. I wouldn't necessarily say that we have had that here in Rochester. And I would actually even ask John a question, because one of the problems that we have in Beechwood is, so there's a choice. Would I prefer to have an out-of-town, out-of-state, out-of-country investor buy a property in my neighborhood, or have John Greenbaum, his family, and some other folks come in?
Yeah, I don't want people just coming in and flipping it.
I'd prefer to have someone that you could actually touch, you could see, you have an opportunity to say, who would want to understand, and because I've worked with John, who would want to understand the culture of folks that are there, because one of the things that we have seen is we're actually not too much that different in terms of the things that I come from a cultural historical perspective and really trying to give an accurate depiction of African Americans, because a lot of times if you just watch TV, you're going to get it wrong. Depiction of it, that we are very loving, we love education, we value work, we value land. That's historical, and that's the truth. That's what I grew up on. And having folks who value that same culture and want to keep that character. So it is a choice. And I would also even challenge further. So when the people left, where'd they go? We tend to just say, again, they left. Where'd they go? Well, we just get left, and that's the end of the story. It's not the end of the story. Where did they go?
Well, now, when John brings up this idea of, maybe a policy, probably a city-level policy that says, you know, we're going to protect people. So if your assessments go up, you know, really rapidly, you know, you're not pushed out. You can't even afford the taxes anymore, which is what John saw in history. Would it be, and I'll start with you, John, and then I'll ask our whole panel this, because I haven't seen policy like this. Would it be something like, you know, let's say we set basically a ceiling that if your assessment goes up more than 10% over a decade, I don't know what it is, but pick a number. Once it goes beyond that, you know, you can't be taxed anymore at that level, that we set a ceiling over time. I mean, John, is that kind of the idea, or any idea on how that would work?
And is it based on your income?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say yes. The conversation I've had is that it could be a formula. X percentage of assessment increase triggers some sort of intervention, which might be about income eligibility and some sort of ceiling. I've also heard that it could be like front end, but then collect on the back end when the house is sold, right? So the city could get its piece, but after the house is sold, if you know, the owner occupant passes and it goes through to the family, well, then the family could take ownership. But if they sell it, then the taxes would accrue back to the city. So, you know, these are all conversations that hopefully candidates for city council and mayor will be having this summer going into the fall.
But, John, you haven't heard either past mayors, the current mayor administration.
Well, me and George were actually at meetings with Lovely when she was city council representative, and we were talking about, Lovely, these are great development plans, but what if they succeed?
Yeah,
and that's where I'm a big believer in. And John, please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it belongs to the people. When we were successful with the roofing program, responding to what people wanted, what we brought the people out. We said, "Here, you tell your story," because we could talk for you. But the elderly came out; they told their stories. I'm not always just going to wait on someone else. I believe that again, we have agency in this. Why can't we say, for those who believe in this initiative, that I don't want to get pushed out of my neighborhood, there should be some type of tax freeze based off of income, and at the same time we're educating. Why can't we do that? I don't think there's anything that stops us from doing that, just like we've had successful campaigns before.
All right, Bob, you want to jump in as well? Go ahead.
Well, I do. I think, yes, Neighborhood of the Arts is really an example of where we've had that, because the median income in Neighborhood of the Arts is $84,000, which is more than the county and the rest of the city. So we've seen that being a reality there. But I want to come back, and George, a good point. We did so many roofs, and we did them. I did them not only in the South Wedge, but I did them in Plex Neighborhood, 19th Ward. And that was a huge issue, is that we had seniors who wanted to stay in their house, an age in place, if you will, but they had leaky roofs. They had problems. And I don't know, we did 50, say 100-some roofs, and we barely made a difference. So I think it's important that we focus on there's real housing needs to make these homes better so that people can not only stay and live in them, but live in a safe, warm environment that have a safe furnace and things like that. So I think that becomes important. I think when you look at these out-of-town buyers, whenever we've had them, and my experience has been with them, they buy it not realizing what they're buying. They think because a house is only $50,000, it's a great deal. But if you're in New York and pay $3,000 a month rent, and you see a house for sale in Rochester at $50,000, you're like, that's going to be a lot of money. But you don't realize you're not getting the rents you anticipate. So I think we got to be cautious. I think with George, we got to have people we can touch and go over and pull them in, and I think that's what's going to be important on the gentrification stuff.
I'm super late for a break, but let me just close to John, because John's phone call, I think, again, I just want to say, John, I really admire your viewpoint on this. So last question, when you look at your neighborhood now, you know, do you have any regrets about moving there, or do you feel like anything could have changed to prevent some of the development, some of the gentrification as you see it in Neighborhood of the Arts, John?
Well, I regret that I didn't push hard enough to start a land trust here. That, you know, that would have stabilized housing prices for at least some people in the neighborhood. So, you know, I could have I could have done something and I didn't, so that's on me. Yeah, that's about it. I mean, we're out thousands and thousands of dollars, but I can always get gluten-free cupcakes and espresso. So that.
That, I mean, you chose the most. That's quite a way to describe it. I mean, that was probably the most cliche way you could have described it on purpose, I assume, John. But thank you, John. Thanks for sharing your story and making us think about it. I appreciate that.
All right.
And you know what? John's story will, I think that this is not only Tiana Mignon's story and open mic, John's story, it's going to make us really think about when we sit down with candidates for mayor, candidates for city council this year, as we talk about that. Because I think Tiana, George, Bob, they're right. You don't wait until you get to a situation like Boston or New York City, Manhattan with gentrification. You look at Rochester and say, is it happening now? Could it happen? And how do you, you know, make sure you've got policies in place to deal? John says we don't. We could. We'll see. We're late for a break. We're going to come back, get more of your phone calls. Phones are going nuts now, so we'll continue after this short break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, astrobiologist David Grinspoon joins me. David is the author of the new book, Earth in Human Hands, and he's looking at our chances for surviving on this planet for a long time, and I mean a really long time. What are our chances to really be here for millions more years? He says we have to start acting like a civilization that does plan to stick around. Yes, it's about climate change and a lot more. We'll talk to him next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you go to openmicrock.com, you can find Tiana Mignon's piece on gentrification that sparked this discussion. It's an outstanding piece of work, and you can see that it's a community discussion that's different from street to street and place to place, but it's the kind of discussion that's vital. I think you just saw that with John's phone call, and we're going to spend the rest of the hour just fielding your calls and comments and letting our guests kind of handle them. So here's one from Carolyn from Rochester off air. She wanted to call in and say that she used to live in Market View Heights, and she's not a fan of outside entities buying properties in the area and managing from afar. She thinks property owners should be local. George, what do you think about that?
I agree with Carolyn. And it just comes from personal experience. And when there's an issue at a home or with the tenant, you want to be able to talk to someone who has really skin in the game beyond just paying the rent sometimes. And when you have to, we have a building right behind the NEED office.
Northeast Area Development.
Northeast Area Development on Webster Avenue. And the owner, he works for Goldman Sachs in New York City. We worked for 2 years. He finally came in town, and it was just like we actually taped the conversation because it was like nobody would believe that he didn't – this place is a mess. Don't you see this? He was like, well, what's wrong with this? Well, first of all, if you back up, you're going to fall through this floor. Second of all, we've been complaining about drugs at this place. Has no one been telling you these things? So, again, we'd prefer to have someone neighborly that we could just go and talk to, say, as neighbors, as community members, there's an issue. How can we work this out? And what we have seen, I'm hoping it gets better when you have these huge conglomerates buying large pieces of property and you have fly-by-night property management companies. It's a problem. It destabilizes neighborhoods.
And would you say that that's one of the biggest issues in the Northeast?
It's a destabilizer. It can have a huge destabilizing effect because you have people who are just trying to make the buck. They're not actually, who cares about the character? Mm-hmm. Who cares about the culture? All I care about is how much I'm going to be able to get for rent.
Yeah, flip this house should be called Gentrify This Neighborhood. that show. Maybe, Bob, or am I wrong, Bob?
I fully agree with you. I agree with George. The worst situations I ever had were those out-of-town owners who didn't care. They wouldn't call you back. Mm. You couldn't get something fixed. You know, and you're trying to say, how do you take a family that they don't have any heat? And it's the middle of winter, and it's 10 degrees below zero, and you can't find anybody to fix it. That's wrong. Sorry. I just get excited about that.
That's okay. Carolyn, thank you. Let me get back to our phones. Frank in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Frank.
Hi. I have a story that I think is pretty amusing. When my wife and I bought our co-op apartment in East Village in New York on St. Mark's Place, we paid $130,000 for it. My wife was a waitress at the New York Hilton coffee shop, and I was a bike messenger. And I'll never forget, when we were moving in, we had a group of people come up to us and accuse us of gentrifying the neighborhood. And I just was, I understand it was a slightly different dynamic. A lot of the rental units were being converted into co-ops, but you know, it was a reasonable price that somebody that was really lower working class could afford to buy. That apartment now is worth over $1.5 million, and
you could get
that
much.
Has been transformed into something that I no longer recognize. And it's, I mean, somebody, I guess, is always going to feel like they're getting shoved out or they're getting the short end of the deal.
Well,
and I thought that.
Well, hold on one sec, Frank. I mean, and I know Bob wants to jump in. Bob, hold it for one second. I just want to say to Frank, I mean, I understand, you know, from your experience, you feel like, well, there's always going to be someone feeling like they're getting the short end of the deal. But in many places there are, though, right? I mean, wouldn't you say, though, Frank, I mean, your story is one instance where you were sort of accused of gentrifying. But I mean, you listen to John's story who just called. There are people who just simply were living in neighborhoods for many years, and all of a sudden their assessments may be up 50% in a decade, and you can't even pay the taxes anymore. I mean, that's a real consequence, right?
Mm-hmm. I understand, and I think that in some cases the idea of income-based or age-based modification mm-hmm. of tax rates is something that is appropriate and should be considered. But at the same time, I mean, I don't understand how you can prevent people from trying to move into a more desirable neighborhood. And I mean, like I said, the problem now is that if you look at Manhattan, for example, somebody who works for a living, and when I say works for a living, I'm not talking about somebody who's an executive, but somebody who has, you know, a job that maybe pays $50,000, $60,000 a year is completely unable to buy a unit anywhere in Manhattan. And it's really unfortunate. I just, the neighborhoods have just turned into these enclaves of, you know, mostly white, mostly affluent people who have changed the character of the places that they've lived in.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Frank, thank you. I know, Bob, you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think some of those, it's interesting when in New York, because some of those prices have gotten so high that I'm not sure who lives in these, where you were talking about, he was talking about, those are probably worth $3 to $4 million now. So what you have is you have these new family units that you need to afford some of the rent in New York City. You need to have 5 or 6 roommates. I have students who have come to work in New York City, and there's 6 of them that share an apartment. So that's the only way they can afford to live, and they have a very small place. So I think that's a huge thing. But it's caused by growth and the demand for units, which, unfortunately, we don't have in Rochester.
I mean, look at
think we're going to come back to the tax base, so that if we could see the whole city tax base move up and the tax expenses stay the same, the rate would actually go down. So I think we got to look at how that math works there, too.
All right. Well, I want to squeeze in as many listener calls and comments as we can get. This is Andrew in Cobbs Hill in Rochester. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, I'm a member of the Coalition to Save Cobbs Hill Park. And you may know or may not know that within Cobbs Hill Park, there are 60 units for seniors. They're low income. The average rental right now is $414 a month. And the plan is to remove that, tear it down, and create units with rentals ranging from $657 to $1,000 per month. So this, in the very white part of the city, this actually is the most integrated part we have. And so the same thing is happening, I'm concerned about, and we're concerned about, not only for home ownership, but rental homes.
So you're saying it's one of the whitest part of the city, it's the most integrated part of the whitest part of the city, and it's about to get whiter.
And it's about, yes, and we're holding a meeting about this on Monday at the New Life Presbyterian Church. For people to get educated about it.
Well, Andrew, so a couple of things. I'm going back to what George Moses said earlier. At least, you know, as you're engaged. You are holding meetings. You're involved. I mean, George has been really pushing this message of, you know, that you have some agency here, that you can step up, you can try to make some change and not just kind of sit back. But who's driving that decision right now, Andrew? Who's responsible for that?
It's our own, the buildings are owned by Rochester Management. They're a nonprofit.
Nonprofits make a lot of money too, but okay.
And that's actually a great.
Yeah, it just means that you can't give the money back to shareholders.
All right, Andrew, stay here. Our guests want to comment. Go ahead, George Moses.
Right. So one of the things I would actually, as he's talking, I'm thinking actually about a meeting I attended with Councilman Mike Patterson, GP4H. They're the group. You saw some of them at the meeting that you went to. They're over on the corner of Hayward and 4th Street, talking about what's going on in their neighborhood. And I was looking at the table, the older folks that were there, folks who had been in neighborhoods for a lot of years, exercising their agency. They were sitting there telling the councilman, this is what I need. And he was pushing back saying, okay, tell me specifically, what do you need? And here's how we can do it. So what our caller just did is he pulled down the curtain on the whiz. What's wrong with saying who some of these developers are and going to these developers? I have seen neighborhood residents meet with developers and change some of these plans. I've seen it. So I'm not something that I think. I know it can happen. I saw it. East Main, now called Warfield. I saw what those residents around that did in the Emma neighborhood and the Beachwood neighborhood and said, well, look, we got to have some changes to this development. It can't just be what you want. What about what we want in terms of keeping the culture and the character of this neighborhood? So I would really encourage those folks. Rochester Management has a main office.
Again, I'm sorry, George and Andrew, the company involved is Rochester Management Corporation?
Management Incorporated, yeah.
I don't know them, but
we have met with them.
But you got two journalists on this panel, and we'll call them. You know, I don't mean to shake them down. I don't know them. Might be very nice people, and might be something I'm missing. But
if they're nice, they'll call back.
Well, sure. Often they don't, right, Tiana? But Andrew, we're going to give them a call, and maybe that's a future conversation because we've been talking about gentrification sort of in the macro here in Rochester, thanks to Tiana's piece, and maybe Andrew's phone call will prompt us to learn in more granular, you know, in one specific example, something that Andrew's worried about as part of the Cobbs Hill area. So we'll give them a call and we'll try to revisit for you, Andrew. And in the meantime, if you want to email me separately, edawson@wxxi.org, we will follow up on that. I'm going to squeeze in one more phone call, Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes. How you doing, George? It's Reverend King.
Hey, Reverend King.
The Beachwood nursing home that you were talking about, that was going to be at one time the first black-owned nursing home, plus the Minnesota Alliance was looking to buy it. And I was on the research committee for that building, and we found out the owner also had places in New York City, and his home place was in Florida, and he was in Florida. And he was willing to give us that building for little of nothing. So we got a lawyer, and then we got some inspectors to come in and inspect the building. And the building was so full with asbestos and a lot of other things. And on top of that, the people in the neighborhood did not want anything else there. So the people, when our inspectors came in, they told us it would be better to just tear the thing down and just start anew. But we couldn't start anew because the people in the neighborhood didn't want that there anyway.
I got to jump in, Sam. I'm not familiar with that particular case. Are you George?
I know exactly what he's talking
about. Oh, you do?
But
okay.
Reverend King, actually, I got to correct you. It was the building I was actually speaking about was the building that's going to be built on East Main, the collaboration with Home Leasing. And that was an example of how you can work positively with a developer. Home Leasing was willing to sit down and work with and made several renditions. But as far as the old Beachwood Nursing Home, we had known for years, and there's actually two neighborhood groups that had gotten involved in that. Beachwood was one, and there was another group on the Triangle. A lot of times when you see some of the landowners, they're saying here they just want to get rid of a property. So they try to give it away. But I can tell you right now, that building is occupied and it's actually providing a fantastic service, the Beachwood Nursing Home, to the neighborhood. So I think timing sometimes is the issue on some things.
Okay. And you're going to read more from what George had to say to Tiana in Tiana's piece. Bob Boyd, about 20 seconds. Final thoughts from you, sir. Go ahead.
Let's keep working to make sure we understand it and retain the culture, keep our citizens safe, but let people age in place.
Bob Boyd's the former executive director of the South Wedge Planning Committee. Thanks for taking the time for the program this hour, Bob.
Great. George, nice to talk with you.
It's always a pleasure, Bob.
And George, you know, we probably could have done this all day, I guess. It's amazing.
That's what we do all day.
George said, that is what we do all day. Thank you. I really always appreciate the time with George Moses, who's executive director of the Northeast Area Development Rochester and Group 14621. And Tiana Mignone is doing tremendous work for Open Mic Rochester, openmicroc.com, to read her and the team there. We're going to keep reading you, and you're always generous with your time coming in and sharing it with us. So we're going to keep bringing you back here. Thank you, Tiana. Great work on this. Let's get a short break and more connections straight ahead.